And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm pleased to welcome Debbie Shriver to the program today. Debbie is a writer of nonfiction who lives in Knoxville, Tennessee, and her previous books include To Read My Heart, The Journal of Rachel Van Dyke, 1810 to 1811, In the Footsteps of Champions, The University of Tennessee Lady Volunteers, The First Three Decades, and Ice and Go, Score in Sports and Life, co-written with noted athletic trainer Jenny Moshack. Today we'll be talking about her most recent book, Whispering in the Daylight, The Children of Tony Alamo's Christian Ministry and Their Journey to Freedom, which looks at the religious cult started by Tony and Susan Alamo in the late 1960s in Southern California and expanded to Western Arkansas in the mid-1970s and continued to exploit adults and children alike for five decades. Debbie, when had you first heard of the Alamos and when did you first decide to investigate and write about them?
I first learned about them 4 years ago. The man who adopted them, he and his wife, were looking for someone to do a story about the children to try to help them express the emotions that they have that they weren't expressing. They were concerned about them because they weren't really adjusting very well to the life outside the cult. They were pretending to fit in, but they had a lot of anger and emotion that just wasn't coming out. And they thought if they wrote about it, it might help. So they found me.
Without his followers and their children and their children's children, there wouldn't be a reason for this book because he would just be a crackpot.
Right. Exactly. He was a promoter and he went to California after graduating from high school because he wanted to be a big guy in the music business and in the film industry, anywhere he could in California. And the only way he could really do that was to promote other people. And that's what he did with his wife, Susan, who was a church scammer from the start. And they brought in followers who really were just wanting to find God and find a nice community of like-minded people to live together. And it was in the 70s when a lot of hippies, my age people, were going to California to find something better.
Tony was born in the Missouri Ozarks.
Yes.
And Susan was born in the Arkansas Ozarks.
Yes.
How did they end up in California?
Well, Susan graduated from high school, got married, had a baby, and then got divorced and decided she wanted to be a film star. And she had a little girl, and she made her way to California, and they were very poor. And the way they earned money to support themselves was through scamming churches. On Sunday, Susan would get up and say to her little girl, "Come on, honey, we're going to go to a church." And she would put a little dress on, and they would go to the local church, and Susan would testify about something, and then her daughter would sing a song, and they'd pass a love offering, and they would take that to live.
They pretended to be missionaries a lot of the time.
Yes,
right?
They did. When they got to California, Susan tried her skills at acting and failed at them. And she got married and then just sort of was a person looking for a good quick buck. And Tony went to California also to become a star in a different way. They met in a bar. It's almost like two people who never should have come together, each in his own way. Susan and Tony were both kind of dangerous and deadly, and they united to become a really dangerous, abusive group.
Together in game parlance, that's a force multiplier.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, could you pronounce Susan's daughter's name? It's an unusual name, and I've never seen it. I've never heard it pronounced before.
It's Christy Anthon.
Does that mean anything, or is it a neologism?
I do not know. And I did not talk to her. I was able to read manuscripts of her interviews, but I did not talk to her.
Had you tried and she declined?
Yeah. And at the time when I was doing the research, she, I think, was trying to get some restitution. I think she was going to court and just kind of wanted to steer clear of a writer at that point.
When they started their ministry, did they have a particular spin on why people should follow them as opposed to other Christian denominations and churches?
Well, you know, Tony and Susan did what cult leaders often do. They take something familiar and they use the King James Version of the Bible, then kind of interject their own doctrine within that frame. And so they knew how to talk to people who were looking for God, looking for salvation, looking for a community of love. And so they used that language and pulled them in and actually took them up kind of to a secluded place in Saugus Canyon and kept them there. People could leave, But when they came in for the service, they had dinner and then they went to a service. Susan and Tony would collect all the materials that they may have, like if they had flyers from other churches or books or magazines, they would take all those and then give them their tracts and preach to them about Jesus. And it sounded familiar to them. And he didn't really at the beginning, if you first walked in, you would feel this is a nice place. But after the service, if you came with a friend, you were divided and paired with a current member, really kind of hotboxed, taken to a prayer room. It would be a very heavy, heavy, heavy conversion. If you leave here, you will go to hell. If you leave here, the devil will get you. If you leave here, you'll become a prostitute. You'll be a whore. You'll be on drugs. You'll never make it. And in fact, if you stay here, your family will even be saved. That was really powerful and scary.
Were there any major ways they differed from other, we'll just say, aggressive religious organizations like Scientology or Elizabeth Clare Prophet or Reverend Sun Myung Moon?
Mm-hmm. Their strategies are the same. In all cults that you mentioned, the leader is infallible. The leader has a direct line to a greater power. And the leader can even read your mind. The leader is all powerful. And they take your money. They demand who you can see, who you can't, where you can go, and deprive you of sleep, dictate what you can eat, and kind of take over completely. In terms of the doctrine, it was a Christian doctrine with a real spin in that Tony became God, and Tony also picked certain passages that allowed him to beat children severely, allowed him to justify having sex with underage girls as young as 8. He separated the girls and the boys, and he would just pull passages to say it's in the Bible. He also was real big on the conspiracy theory between the Vatican and Catholic Church and the U.S. government.
It kind of reminded me of Lyndon LaRouche and the way he was in the 80s and 90s.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, it almost doesn't matter what the text is, what the matter is, but it's the way, the means that a cult leader gets power, and it's through those psychological means.
Now, how many people had they gathered together in California?
Before they moved from California, they had 800 to 1,000 people there.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how many made the trip to Arkansas with them when they moved?
The first batch of people were about 300, I think, and he was running from the feds. He started to kind of get on the radar in terms of wage and salary issues. He had children working long hours. He had adults working long hours. And anything they earned outside the church went to the church, and that was Tony. But he was aware that he was being circled by the IRS, and so he announced to his flock that California is going to be taken by the devil. Look at all the bad air. Look at the earthquakes. Look at the high temperatures. And so we're going to move, and we're going to move to Arkansas. And if you look at where he moved in Alma, Dyer, and then Falk, it's a kind of a triangle nowhere. You know, it's also the really close to Texarkana, Texas, really close to Muldrow, Oklahoma. And so he could move people across the borders very quickly if he became under the radar of the police, and that's what he did. He left some people in California always, and he said, you know, you're here to keep this compound going. And I always wondered what they thought when they weren't chosen to leave the devil country of California, but they were really still recruiting, and so that was a feeder. And then some more would come to Arkansas, and more would come to Arkansas. Today, this minute, the only compound that is still going is the one in Saugus Canyon, California. And that's still strong.
And who's actually running that now?
It's speculation. There are 4 people who are very close to Tony and pretty big in the church, and they're running it. I don't feel comfortable saying their names,
okay,
but we know they're running it.
When they moved to Western Arkansas and Alma and Dyer, they started this weird collection of businesses, gas stations, a Western wear store, a restaurant that also had a kind of a nightclub aspect to it, had musical performers come in there. It just seemed really weird.
Really weird. Tony liked to take over towns. He was in an ideal location for people to get off the highway and get some gas or get something to eat. And his MO was to have a restaurant, invite people for food, and then take them to service. And so a restaurant was kind of his benchmark. And the one in Alma drew a lot of fame. Apparently, the food was really good. It was chicken and kind of home cooking. A lot of students from University of Arkansas traveled there. Sometimes their parents warned them not to get close to the people that were working there. I think probably one of the most notable nights would have been the Saturday when they opened and Dolly Parton was there to open the restaurant with her act, and Bill and Hillary Clinton came down there. In his autobiography, Bill Clinton remarks that Dolly was in good form, as usual, and Tony Alamo and Susan Alamo were a little bit strange, and the people were a little bit strange. And then he went on to reference that later on, Tony really gave him as governor a little bit of trouble. That had to be how he was running past the law. But restaurants were a real draw for him, and he used those to recruit.
Now, how did he square bringing in celebrities from this wicked, wicked world outside the carnality, as he would say, into his holy, holy place?
He was so two-faced, and he wanted to look a particular way to the outside world, and he pulled that off pretty well. I think you and I can look at his pictures, and we look at him and think, you know, how could that guy have been famous and revered? And he wasn't really, but he knew how to promote. He knew how to kind of rev people up and put people together. And he built this entourage that was always with him. And so he had a stir all around. Susan had charisma. She was the preacher, and she drew a lot of people as well. He fancied himself an Elvis. Here we are in Memphis. I really have been thinking about that and how he tried to look like Elvis and pattern himself after Elvis. And in Nashville, he had a store where Alamo Designs sold blue jean bedazzled jackets that the children made, air sprayed t-shirts, all kinds of clothes. And they were also, the jackets on eBay right now carry pretty hefty prices. They were at one time carried in Macy's and Saks Fifth Avenue and stores on Rodeo Drive. And so I think he positioned himself to the outside world in a way that, well, he's quirky, but look at all the good he's doing, because he was collecting things for charity. And he was enabling, somebody would ask for something and he would work with that person. He particularly groomed relationships with people who had money and gave them good bargaining power. It was about money and power, and he was able to present himself as that to the outside world.
Now, I grew up about 50 miles away from Alma, where the kind of the headquarters of the operation was near, and tracts. Yeah. Under the windshield wipers of our car, every time you'd go to Walmart, you would get an Alamo track, it seemed like.
Yeah. And the kids talk about going tracting. And he would assign a team of children to go with usually two sisters. That's what they call the adult women there. And they would go in a van, a white van, and have boxes and boxes of tracks. And they went all over the country. They went to New York. They are very well traveled. They would get out in the middle of the night or during a big event like a football game. They told me about tracting here in Memphis during a UT Memphis State at that time game, football game. It was the only time they really saw the outside world, and they were fascinated but frightened at the same time. And they loved to run from the police. They had to give those tracks out, and thousands and thousands. And it was very brutal. It was very hard work. And they also worked the printing shop and put those pamphlets together. Today, tracting is happening just about every day in New York City in a pretty heavy way.
From the Alamos?
Yes. They're the same tracts, by the way.
Yeah, those and Jack Chick were the ones I remember seeing when I was growing up.
Yeah.
I mean, they were both entertaining in their very own very odd ways.
Oh, very odd. Very odd. And I have to tell you, NBC and Sundance are doing a docuseries with the book as well as more than the book. The way they discovered the topic is from someone who handed a producer a track.
Wow.
So it was kind of poetic justice.
Now, you mentioned that Tony liked to take over a town when he got there. How did the people in Alma and Dyer react to this odd group of people?
Terribly. And Fowke is the other place where Tony really took hold. Georgia Ridge and Dyer was raided for tax evasion. So that property was taken away from him, and he served some time in prison. Still, being in prison didn't deter his leadership. Things went on just as healthy as if he were there. But Alma was pretty much just the businesses. But when he settled in Fowke, he took over. He kind of wed himself to the mayor and had church members on the city council. there was a dispute that's pretty well known in that community, is there was a public street that ran alongside of the compound property. His guards would stand at that street with guns and not allow people who lived down that street on the non-compound side in during certain times. They would go to city council and the mayor wouldn't really stand up for them. He had the fire department watering his grounds. It was a huge abuse. And Falk, when the election came for the mayor, the people of Falk really turned out and worked really hard. And Cecil Smith, who was the mayor, was defeated. And he hasn't been heard from since. And Tony did still have somebody on the city council, but he lost a lot there. But there are pictures of him receiving best citizen for the town and all kinds of things. When I went to Falk with the book, it was obvious that that town still feels the sting of Tony Alamo. They're ashamed because they didn't know what was going on.
They just want everyone to go up to the Falk monster
exactly.
and take a picture there.
Exactly.
Because that is the town that was the basis of the legend of Boggy Creek was
yep.
shot in that area.
Yep. And for a while, I thought that was the same as Tony Alamo.
Now, before Tony went to jail for the first time for his tax problems, Susan died of breast cancer in 1982. And her supposed last words are pretty damning.
Absolutely. And I know this is a fact. I talked to a source who was in the room, and she said, "Tony, when I die, you're going to have to break up the church or you'll wreck it." She knew that he couldn't really do it. He never preached in church. He was rarely in a church service. Susan is the one that did it. He was the promoter. He promoted her. And I think he was really, really afraid that he would lose his power and his money and his followers when she died. So he worked a plan to try to keep the flock together, and it did work. He dressed Susan in a bridal gown, and she was embalmed, and took her in a casket to Dyer, and put the casket on the dining room table, and had his followers pray her to resurrection 24/7 for 6 months.
And we actually heard about that going on.
Did you?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Did you believe it?
We believed that that was going on. We didn't believe that she'd be resurrected.
Right. Good clarification.
It was also strange driving on Interstate 40 on the north side near Dyer. There was always a black car parked in front of a road going up the hill there.
Yeah. Oh,
and
wow.
just when you'd pass by and you'd always see it was either like a Lincoln or a Cadillac
yep.
parked
yep.
right in front of that road, blocking it off from
yep.
outside.
That was definitely evidence of his presence.
What kind of shift was there in the preaching after Susan died? How did Tony's approach to religion differ from Susan's?
Tony still did not preach in church, but he continued to make tapes and CDs and did it in a real rapid way all the time. They had a recording studio in his home. He also got more brutal as the church leader and instilled much more fear than before. Particularly, he was always horrible to women and girls. Susan is really the only woman he really, I do believe he loved her. I think it was also a kind of a mutual greed that they both had in terms of their attraction. But when she died, he became really brutal to children. He took little girls, as soon as they had their period, he would say, "You can be my wife." Parents saw it as an honor if he chose their little girl. They never really allowed families to stay intact, and he became much more aggressive about splitting people up after Susan left so that no one really had a comfort zone. And everyone was afraid of everyone else, and it was everyone's job. He maintained his discipline system through a tattling system.
It sounded like the way the East German Stasi
Absolutely.
Kept people in line during the communist era.
Absolutely. He had girls living in his house as well. And if you were chosen to live in his house, it was perceived as an honor. And he took many wives. He would say in his interviews that he was not a polygamist, but he wasn't against polygamy, but that he was married to one person at a time. In one of his interviews, he was accused of being a serial husband, but he had always had someone that he was legally by the U.S. married to, but then he had many other wives and many children. And he did not do that when Susan was alive. I think that's the biggest change we saw. He became much more vicious. And I think the reason was he was afraid. He did not want to lose his base. and he didn't.
There was very little consistency from his decrees. I've heard that intermittent rewards or punishments are the best way to keep someone performing.
Yeah. You know, and the children and adults never knew what they even had done for the punishment that they received. And sometimes it would be an incredibly harsh beating in front of everyone, really brutal. And other times it would be fasting. And other times it might just be something kind of light for the very same thing.
Diesel therapy.
As a young man, if you had lived there and done something that was out of favor with Tony, diesel therapy was something that the boys endured. Tony had a transportation business, a trucking business, and actually it is based in New Jersey. And he had a liquidation business. All the donations given to his church by people and corporations who intended these donations to be for charity.
Like Hurricane Katrina.
Right, like Hurricane Katrina. All these things went into warehouses where children worked to resort them, repackage them, remove expiration dates with acetone from food cans. And they were repackaged and then sent on these trucks to various places in the U.S. And little boys who did something wrong were condemned often to diesel therapy, which meant they had to ride in the truck with a brother, who they called the adult members, all over the U.S. And I said, kind of naively, I asked one of the children that I interviewed, well, did that feel like a break from being there? You know, maybe thinking if you were off with one guy who was a parent, maybe that would be kind of a relief. No, not at all. It was torturous. And generally, these boys were beaten so hard it hurt for them to sit. And it was really torturous.
Some people were excommunicated on a whim. Mm-hmm. Other people were beaten to keep in line. Some people left voluntarily. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of give us the story of everything that the church did to Quinn and Glenn, who was one of Tony's right-hand men?
Yes. Glenn grew up in a very well-educated, well-to-do home in California, and he was the youngest of his siblings. Everyone went to college. Everyone excelled. When it came time for him to go to college, he didn't want to, and he really didn't know what he wanted, but he was kind of the rebel in the family. Tony encountered him and convinced him that, in fact, he could be quite a leader in the church and a help to him as an assistant. And that appealed to him because he'd been kind of the black sheep of the family, if you will. He was the youngest, kind of felt overlooked, and Tony knew that. And Tony could see, you need to feel important. You need to feel valued. And so that was his vulnerable place. And so he brought him into the church and had him in his office with them, had him doing important things, trained him in a sense. And Quinn was a young girl. Gosh, Quinn was 15. By this time, Glenn was 30-something. Tony said they needed to marry. Quinn had grown up in the church, so she was born and raised. So she did what she was told. To her, that was a very old man. And she had four children, just right in a row. She was treated really badly. She didn't have help, which is real typical of what happened in the cult. So she convinced Glenn that they needed to leave. And Glenn said, okay, we'll do that. Call your father, who lived in Vermont, have him send us a ticket or something, and you and the children go up there, and then I'll come later. So she did that. He didn't come as he said he would. Tony convinced him to stay, and he really had intended to go, I believe. But he convinced him to stay, and then at some point, Glenn did go back to retrieve his children, and Quinn kept the youngest for a little while. And then he got the youngest one as well and took them back. And they actually lived outside the cult for a little while, then went back to Fort Smith. And Glenn was not the loving father that the children ever remembered. Quinn was kicked out of the church by virtue of what she had done, and that's just leaving. And she was still so young. She hadn't lived. And she had a lot of issues trying to figure out how to be successful in the world. So she had a really hard time. And the children grew up feeling as if they'd been deserted by their mother. But the reality is, and now as adults, they understand. She was just a child when she had them. She couldn't manage all that. And she's doing a lot better now, today. And the youngest is living with her now. But their family has had a really difficult time. And they're an example of the way Tony just takes a unit, a family unit, and plays them against each other and pulls them apart. And when the kids were back, Tony sent Glenn on long trips on the truck. And he'd come back. And then Tony would tell him, or the sister who had kept the children would tell him, all the awful things the children had done. So then he beat the children. And so they got so they dreaded their father coming home because they knew they'd be beaten, and they didn't know what they'd done, but they would be beaten. And often when mothers were drummed out, everyone there then spoke very badly about the mothers. And they grew up learning that their mother was a prostitute, addicted to drugs, gone to the devil, will never be saved. You know, when you're a little kid and you grow up with those beliefs, it's really difficult to even be willing to see your mother again.
What are some common difficulties people who have left the church, especially at the time of the second prosecution, in what ways is it difficult for them to integrate into a bigger society?
There are really two groups that are distinct. First generation people are those who joined as adults or young adults, and they have a pre-cult identity. So once they leave or are taken away, however they separate, with work, they can go back to who they were. They have a sense of their values, their beliefs were crafted before the cult, and they can kind of get back to that and see perspective. They have a lot of trouble with guilt. Mothers in particular have trouble with guilt for allowing their children to be punished so severely and to be abused so terribly. Shame is a real common denominator, and it's very difficult. It's really difficult for the mothers, particularly, to move forward. The children, people who are born and raised, don't have a pre-cult identity. They are wired the way the cult leader has taught. So they don't know trust. Tony did not teach trust. They don't know love. Tony did not teach love. In fact, they believed, they were taught that God is a hateful God. He used that word, hateful God. God is not a God of love. There isn't anyone I met that wasn't smart. So they come out wanting to fit in. This generation in particular, in the born and raised children that are coming out of cults today, are coming out pretty much as teenagers. And if you think about when you were a teenager, that's a time when you're really testing out things and you're feeling kind of love-hate for all kinds of issues. And it's a difficult time. Well, put on top of that, if you were coming from a place that was a whole community of abuse that was bound by a doctrine that you now are told was filled with lies, they don't know what's true and what isn't. Anything that happens that creates any kind of uncomfortable response, they think it's because they were in a cult, and sometimes it's something everybody experienced. They don't have a context. They pretend. That's why we did this book, so that these children could express more and get deeper, so we can learn from them. Therapists, DCS workers, people on the front line haven't known up to now how to really help children in particular when they're taken away from the only world they've ever known. And we can say we rescued them. They didn't see that as a rescue. They were being taken from the only home they loved, however they loved it. And they thought they were going to be killed. So it's really hard.
It's amazing what we as humans can become accustomed to.
Absolutely. When I interviewed these young people, they would tell me all this horrific stuff. And of course, you know, I didn't respond in any way other than listening. At some point, though, I said, did you ever laugh? Did you ever, you know, have that range of emotions? And they said, oh, we had fun. Yes, we had fun. And I said, well, tell me what you did that was fun. They sat there a minute, and the little boy said, we played with nails. And I thought, that really isn't what I would define as fun. You know, what they did for fun was really carving out a piece of something interesting from the work they were forced to do. When this little boy was 8 years old, he was working on roofing on houses. And that's when he was playing with nails. And I said to him, "Weren't you afraid up there, way high on a second-story building?" And he said, "Yeah, but it wasn't as scary as my father." We are resilient. We find a way, particularly children, find a way to play, even in the worst of circumstances.
And I really appreciate the fact that you gave space for several of the children to have personal essays in the book near the end.
That was really important. This is their story, and they are the first ones who have spoken out of all the cults. They are the first ones who have really stepped out there and spoken in a context that isn't a memoir. It's different from a memoir because it's a little bit more objective, and it was difficult and brave for them. And it clearly, they're all struggling, and they're doing really well. They will always have some pieces that don't quite fit, and they're doing really well. It was important for that to be in the book, and I think probably that's the strongest part. I'd like to think that my writing's the strongest part, but truly, their words are what give strength to this book and story. Their words are what compelled me in the first place to try to make a difference. And we all need to know that cults are alive and well and growing. And they're our neighbors. They're in our communities. There's a lot of hesitancy to step into that because it's grounded as a religion and often is practiced like a religion. We need to do something, though, about coercive, abusive groups and at least try to save the children. There's a lot of suffering. And when they come out, they don't have birth certificates. They've not seen doctors. They know nothing. And they don't even know what a family unit is. They're put in a foster family, but they didn't know what family mother and father looked like. They lived in dorms or they lived shuffled from place to place. And so there's no familiarity out here. Those voices in that book can help us get to a point where when a therapist sees a child who comes out of a cult, that child will say, "You do get me. You get it." And that's big.
Now, of course, researching this book, talking with these children, getting to know them, it's going to have a huge emotional impact on you as well. As a writer, how do you move forward into a different topic from immersing yourself in this world?
It was very hard to do. But on my worst days, I just remembered I don't have a bad day. This is their story. And I can't even imagine. They let me get as close as I could to them. And I can't imagine what it would be like to go through what they went through. All the ways people are being terrorized in different ways now. Right now, I think where my energy is going is to set up a foundation to help cult survivors. And the profits from this book are the seed money, and you don't make a lot on books. So I'm also hoping that I want people to become more knowledgeable. I hope people will listen to your radio show, and I hope people will read the book and see everything they can to become more educated. And what I'd like this foundation to do is not only help provide direct help to people coming from cults, but I'd also like for us to provide education, ways for therapists to continue to learn more, ways for human services workers, pastors, police, all those frontline people, so that we can, in fact, get these kids to a safe place. And it will mean a big difference in our future. So I'm connected to the cause and seeing that, in fact, there's a wake-up call involved here. I was awakened, certainly, when they approached me. And I think if we can do that, I'll feel as if this was worth it.
You use the very specific term high-demand cult. What other types of cults are there that people might look out for?
The spiritually abusive cults can come in many, many forms, and they're not always in group forms. They can be one-on-one. For example, a psychic can control another person. And really, the definition of an abusive cult is one where the leader or the dominant person uses undue influence over another. And doctors can do that. Counselors can do that. Pastors can do that. Anyone in a leadership role, in fact, can do that. You know, I think the line gets drawn when people really can't walk away, when people start being kind of sucked in to give more money, to give up friends, to give up family, to dress a certain way, to go by rules that really don't make a whole lot of consistent sense. Then on the far end of that spectrum, a cult isn't necessarily good or bad. There's the, you know, Grateful Dead, Deadhead cult. You know, it's really just a group that's connected by a common passion. But these cults are coercive. They're actually very similar to domestic violence frames within a household. They're coercive, and they damage another person. There are many, many, many. There are over 5,000 in our country and growing. I'll give an example of one. College students are often prayed. There is a cult called the 12th Tribe. Been around about as long as Tony Alama's group. And prey on college students by offering them travel abroad programs in the summer. And they have a real strong holding in Chattanooga. And there's a place there called the Yellow Deli. Has great deli sandwiches. And they run that, which sort of reminds me of Tony with his restaurants. But they offer trip abroad programs for the summer and take college students to third world countries, indoctrinate them to a new frame of reference. By the end of the summer, those kids are members of the 12th tribe. They don't go back to college. They become recruiters and live in communities of the 12th tribe. If they are not converted in the summer, they go to Belgium, where there is a healthy center of 12th tribe members, and they continue to work on them there. It's a terrible organization, and there are many, many cults like this. There are a lot of organizations that are kind of go back to the earth organically. Let's grow our food, and we're going to all live here and have a farm. And that reminds me of the 60s and the 70s. But there are intelligent people who graduate from college, kind of think, you know, I want to do something meaningful. I'm worried about the ecology. I'm not tied down anywhere yet. And there's a directory of communities like this. And some are not coercive. Most are. And you can sign up and then go during a visitor's time. And again, you can be there and leave when you want to, but there are certain things that happen that kind of compel you to think, well, this is pretty good. Like maybe the food is really good. Or, you know, I'm starting to question that outside world. There's a group, Zendik. Have you heard of them?
Mm-mm.
That's a group in North Carolina. They've moved lots of different places. I think they're in West Virginia now. But it's just like that, and it's horrendous. And they base their power on saying who people can date within this group. And it's kind of they have dating on different levels. But if you get too close, then you're a part of this death culture that they say we all live in. And it's all controlled by relationships. So there are many, many different kinds of cults that focus on certain things. And they all take away the individual spirit, bottom line.
There's, of course, been a lot of documentaries, and you mentioned they're working on one about the Alamos. But I recently saw a science fiction film called The Endless. And have you heard of this movie?
No.
It came out, I think, maybe last year. And it's about two brothers who were in a cult growing up, and they had escaped about 10 years prior because they thought there was going to be a mass suicide. But it ended up not happening. And one of the brothers really wants to go back and meet those people. He hadn't been able to let go of that emotional bond with those people. And they go back, and it seems the people haven't aged in that interim. And then you learn that the entire area has become unstuck from time. And so as a metaphor of being separated from the world outside, it was a really strong, strong, interesting movie on those kind of dynamics.
Oh, I want to see that. That sounds really good. You know, and it's interesting, the children who are young adults now in the book still have family in the cult. And they worry about them, and they fantasize going back to get them. One in particular said, I'd just like to pretend I'm coming back and then get her out, get my sister out. You know, and I said, it doesn't work that way. She has to want to come out. And it is a whole nother world. It truly is. That's powerful.
Well, Debbie, I want to thank you so much for coming by and sharing these stories with us today. It's very much been an honor to have you here.
Oh, thank you. It's been a real honor to be here. I appreciate it.
Debbie Shriver is the author of Whispering in the Daylight, The Children of Tony Alamo's Christian Ministry and Their Journey to Freedom, which is published by University of Tennessee Press. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.